Hello, you are listening to the Movie Music and Trivia Show on 91.7 WSUM Madison. And I am very happy to announce that we have a really cool show lined up for you today. It's the Steve McQueen Film Festival in New York that we're going to this weekend. And we just wanted to feature a bunch of music from all of Steve McQueen's films. So we're going to start off with The Blob from 1958, and I suppose I should introduce you. Hey, well, what's your DJ name?
DJ name is Mr. G.
Okay, Mr. G, even though that's also
or
another.
Or Dr. G.
Okay, we'll call you Dr. G.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. And I'm Catherine Garcia, and I hope you'll stick around.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Thank you.
The Magnificent Seven.
1960. And I saw that, I'm sorry to say, I actually saw that in the theater as a young teenager.
That's all right.
And The Time Machine also came out in 1960, so we won't get off the track with that. But
The Time Machine.
The Magnificent Seven, you see it on TV all the time. And most people know Steve McQueen was in this movie along with Yul Brynner. It's kind of a funny story about Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, because Steve McQueen was about 5'10", and Yul Brynner wasn't too much taller. But he always wanted to seem taller than Steve McQueen in the movie. So he had, for his scenes, he had this mound of dirt mounded up so that he could stand on it, and he would appear a little bit taller than Steve McQueen. And in between takes, whenever Steve McQueen would walk past the mound, he'd kick at it.
He was always an attention getter, though, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Like, I remember reading some articles about how he used to use his hands a lot in his films, so people would always be drawn to him no matter what.
Right.
Because he was always fidgeting around.
And that drove Yul Brynner crazy on this movie because he did a lot of that stuff. There was one scene where he was, before a gunfight, he would be shaking his shotgun shells, and then he'd be looking at the sun, and he'd take his hat off, and he'd shade his eye. This is all while Yul Brynner's supposedly doing all the main stuff, but he was always stealing the scene.
Right.
Because of all of this business that he does. And this is true through most of his movies. That's what he's famous for, is working with whatever tools he has at hand. And so he was a real scene stealer. And talking about the reason why we're doing the show, the Steve McQueen marathon or introspective or retrospective, I don't know what you would call it in New York. It started today, and they're showing all of his movies, or quite a few of his movies, at the Lincoln Center in New York City. And we're going to be there this weekend. Yeah, to Ooh. Catch a couple of movies, and they're going to be The Towering Inferno on Sunday, and then we're going to see The Sand Pebbles on Monday, which is my favorite movie of all the Steve McQueen movies, but which is probably not as well known as some of the Steve McQueen movies that he's done, like Bullet. It's probably his most famous. As we walked into the studio, a lot of the
DJs that were in here, yeah, they all knew who Steve McQueen was.
Except for one.
All the hipsters know Steve McQueen.
He said, "Who's Steve McQueen?"
Right.
And that's probably.
And we laughed, and we probably should have educated him, but we just laughed.
But
and
it's
shook
a,
our heads.
But it's a real legitimate question because he died in 1980. That was like almost 29 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's very common for the younger generation not to really know who Steve McQueen was, but he was quite the item in the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, a lot of the films that he made during this time are fairly well known, and one of the reasons why they're having this show in New York City that started today and is going to roll until, I think it's Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah.
Yeah, so.
The 20th to the 26th.
And Elmer Bernstein, who wrote the score for The Magnificent Seven, which is kind of it's become iconic in a way.
Yeah, everybody knows the theme.
Right, and it's
kind of
a well
Western theme.
Right, because they've even used it in commercials. And it's so well known that he even made fun of his own score when he did the score for The Three Amigos. So he kind of drew on this score, and so it kind of gave that movie a little more weight because everybody was familiar with the original score. So those are a few of the tidbits that go along with...
That's great for the Movie Music and Trivia Show.
Mm-hmm.
On 91.7 WSC1 Madison. And we have coming up next, The Great Escape. And that's also Elmer Bernstein. Bernstein or Bernstein? I wonder what the correct pronunciation is.
I say Bernstein, but...
Bernstein.
You say tomatoes, I tomatoes.
Right, right. And then after that, we have Soldier in the Rain from 1964. That was Henry Mancini. And then some more Elmer Bernstein with Baby, the Rain Must Fall. And I'm sure nobody saw that one. That was 1965.
One of his lesser-known movies. In fact, I know I saw it, but I can't remember much about it. I'd have to look up the subject matter.
Maybe it's not worth looking up.
Well, it was one of those, I think it was, I seem to remember, it was one of those more of a dramatic role that he has in that movie, and it was not a very, I don't think it was a very good movie.
Okay, well, I won't check it out then. Okay, so let's get going with The Great Escape.
Thank you. Hello, this is Ben,
Clancy,
and Travis at WSUM 91.7 FM.
And we would like to encourage you to respect your neighbor.
Remember, a little bit of kindness goes a long way. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together.
Thank you. Some men climb a mountain, some men swim the sea, some men fly above the sky. They are what they must be. But baby, the rain must fall. Baby, the wind must blow. Wherever my heart leads me, baby, I must go. Baby, I must go. I do not love for silver. I do not love for gold. My heart is mine to give away. It never will be sold. So baby, the rain must fall. Baby, the wind must blow. Wherever my heart leads me, baby, I must go. Baby, I must go. I am not rich or famous, but who can ever tell? I don't know now what waits for me. Maybe heaven, maybe hell. Baby, the rain must fall. Baby, the wind must blow.
That was Glenn Yarbrough singing the title track to Baby the Rain Must Fall.
Well, not too much to say about that one. That was quite a slice of history there. I don't think I remember that particular song was a fairly big hit on the radio, and they used to play it all the time. There was no getting away from it. But you asked me if I liked it or not. I said, well, I was kind of indifferent to it. It was okay. I didn't go out and buy the single. But.
Right. And I've never heard of him before, but
oh, he was a big hit during the mid '60s. Yeah, he had some other hits besides this one,
which you can't recall. So we'll move on
mm-hmm.
to the star of the show today, which is Jerry Goldsmith's Sand Pebbles from 1966. All right,
that's when it premiered. The initial shooting for the film itself started in 1965 in November. And the production crew had to go to Taiwan, China, or which was known as Formosa at the time. And Formosa and Red China were basically at war with one another. So having a U.S. film crew there in Taiwan was somewhat of a difficult situation for everybody involved. So that kind of did add to some of the difficulties they had during the filming of the movie. They had other things happen, like earthquakes, and they even had a hotel fire where some of the crew was staying. And the movie...
How do you know so much about this film?
Well, I know so much about this film. It's funny you should ask that, is because I have a website dedicated to this movie, The Sand Pebbles. If you do a Google for The Sand Pebbles on the internet, you'll find my website. It comes in as, I think...
Number one?
It used to be number one, but now it's fallen to number three behind Internet Movie Database and Wikipedia, I believe. So,
really?
But it's up there. I'm happy. It's the website's been around for about 11 years now, so fans of the movie have visited from time to time, and there's still a lot of interest in the movie. It just came out last year on Blu-ray, and before that it came out on DVD. They restored the roadshow version of the film, which was different from the version that was available on DVD all these years. It was longer. It was...
And better? Now, what version is showing on Monday? Actually, right now, the first film for the Steve McQueen film marathon that's going on in New York City is The Sand Pebbles, and that's...
Mm-hmm.
That's today, I believe.
Yeah, what they're showing is what's considered the theatrical release. In other words, it's a shorter version.
Okay.
It's the one that they started to edit down the original Roadshow version to kind of being able to fit more showings into a day, because theater owners were complaining that the movie was too long and they wanted to cut down, but basically they only managed to cut down about 14 minutes, so it wasn't like it was a huge slice, but they took out a few things, and you won't be seeing those in New York when we see the movie on Monday. You'll be seeing the theatrical version, but that version was restored. They went back over and they digitally restored it, and they redid the sound on it, and everyone who's seen it pretty much says it's I guess the best version you're going to ever see of this film, considering its age.
Yeah, well then I guess you probably feel pretty lucky to see this in the theater once again after all this time.
Yeah, it'll be an experience to see it on
the big
screen.
When was the last time that you saw it in a theater?
The first time I saw it was in 1967 after I came back from Vietnam.
Well, this is going to be so profound, I imagine that I will be seeing a tear come from your eye as I look over at you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you'll see many tears.
Oh, I know I will after seeing the ending, because that's always really sad.
Yeah,
we will not talk about the ending of the movie.
No, we won't.
For those that have not yet seen it.
Yeah, but the kicker today was that Candace Bergen, who starred in the movie, actually did the intro to the film before it started. So.
Are you sad that you weren't there to see or to hear her speak about the film?
Yeah, it would have been nice to be able to talk with Candy and, you know, swap stories with her. But
right, but you did say that she didn't really enjoy making this film.
She
complained about it in the past and now.
Right. If she wrote a book in 1984, which was called Knock on Wood, and she detailed all the problems that she had with the filming. And even though she was like only 19 years old when filming started, she considered herself to be quite a great actress. And I think now, and in hindsight, as she looks back on her acting career, she realizes that maybe some of the things she believed and thought at the time weren't quite really the reality of it all, especially when the director is somebody like Robert Wise, who's, you know,
great director. What else did he direct?
A lot of the great movies, West Side Story, of course, this movie, and
The Sound of Music.
The Sound of Music, which is seems to be America's favorite. That once that premiered in theaters, it was hard to kick it out of the theaters because people just kept going to see it again and
kind of like
again.
Jaws.
Yeah, it just they couldn't.
Wasn't Jaws like? Didn't it play like for almost the whole year?
Yeah, and they actually had to when they premiered the Sand Pebbles in New York City, they actually had to remove The Sound of Music. And they weren't real happy to see The Sound of Music go because it was such a moneymaker that just seemed to be going on and on and on. And I, you know, I saw it in the theater quite a few times myself, but he did some really well-known, you know, for maybe some of the younger viewers and listeners, probably seen Star Trek, the motion picture. He did that
one. Oh, right. How can I forget that?
The very first one.
So all you new Star Trek fans out there that have never really watched Star Trek before, you have to go back and see the original Star Trek, the motion picture.
Right, the very first.
And when did that come out? 1979?
Something like that.
Yeah, he directed that. So Robert Wise, cool guy.
Yep, he was.
And we're already in the middle of listening to the overture from the Sand Pebbles.
Ooh, let's get to it.
Okay, and then we'll play a couple more tracks after that.
We'll be right back.
And we're in the middle of listening to the Jake and Shirley track from Jerry Goldsmith's The Sand Pebbles.
The Sand Pebbles was nominated for 8 Academy Awards.
Oh, my.
And it managed to win none of them.
Oh.
But this was Steve McQueen's first and only nomination for an Academy Award, and I think he does probably his best work ever in this movie.
Quite exceptional.
There'd be some debate. Some people like Bullet better, but to me, this is a definitive Steve McQueen, because his role in this movie was much like his own personal life. So I think he brought that to the movie, the loner, the person who comes from a rough background and aims to be successful at something. And in this particular case, he's an engineer, and the ship's engine is his baby, and that's all he's interested in. And his personality undergoes a change during the movie, and he learns to be more open-minded and
to love.
And to love.
Hence the love theme that we're hearing right now.
Right.
It is very beautiful.
Yeah, Jerry Goldsmith.
Won that year.
It was a movie about a lion. Trying to think of what.
But not the Lion King, of course.
No, not the Lion King. For some reason, I know what it is, but it just doesn't come to my mind right now.
Well, yeah, that's too bad. And coming up next, we have Lalo Schifrin's Bullet. So this is music from Bullet, and this is from the Alfred Hitchcock Master of Mayhem CD. And then we'll just hear a couple more tracks from the Bullet CD by Lalo Schifrin after that. And then the Thomas Crown Affair. Thanks for listening to the Movie Music and Trivia Show on 91.7 WSUM Madison. We'll be right back.
Now, this you're hearing is the music that precedes the big car chase in Bullet, and anybody who's familiar with the movie knows the big car chase between the Mustang and the Charger that races through the streets of San Francisco was the first of its kind and just blew people away when they saw this on the screen.
It's still quite impressive if you watch the movie.
Yeah, and when they were racing through some of the highways, they were hitting 110 miles per hour while they were filming the scenes, and they weren't supposed to be going that fast, but they ended up going quite a bit faster.
And no injuries, I hope.
And there were, not that I know of.
There were?
No. Okay. You were asking me why this was called Bullet. Well, the detective, Frank Bullet, it was the...
Oh, listen to this.
Yeah, here we go. Revving it up.
Yeah, this is the end.
Yeah, they used two Mustangs and two Chargers in this movie because they all got banged up pretty bad. But one of the Mustangs did survive, and Steve McQueen wanted to buy it back after the movie, but wasn't able to.
Aw. I can picture it now.
But anyways, there was a stunt driver for this movie as well. Even though Steve McQueen is seen in the car during the chase, they did kind of subtle cuts to make it look like he was actually doing the dangerous stunt driving. But the actual driver was Bud Akins, who also doubled for him in the motorcycle jump in The Great Escape when he jumped over the wire fence. Well, that wasn't really Steve McQueen, though he had attempted it but didn't... crashed and burned.
Ah, Steve. He's a real stuntman. Didn't he, later on in his life, decide to race cars?
Didn't he do that Le Mans movie? Right. He was always racing cars and motorcycles. That was part of his nature. So, yeah, he did do Le Mans later on in his career. But, he was always... he was a speed freak. He liked to get in on...
Fast cars and fast women?
Yeah, pretty much. That was Steve McQueen.
All right, and now we're moving into the Thomas Crown Affair. And that was 1968. Michel Legrand, maybe? Michael Legrand?
Right.
Not sure how to pronounce that, but that's the composer of this film.
Academy Award winning song, The Windmills of Your Mind.
Oh, and I did put that in here. Mm-hmm. So we will have the theme from the Thomas Crown Affair.
So listen for it.
And some dialogue clips also available on the CD. Oh, this is sweet.
Investigate.
Anything in particular?
The bank, Mr. Crowell. The capers, sir. You don't expect us to take the loss of over $2 million lying down, do you?
It's an interesting picture. Pays well, though, huh?
Depends on the return.
Sort of an American-type headhunter.
You could put it that way, yes.
And whose head are you after?
Yours.
Mine?
Yours.
funny, dirty little mind.
It's a funny, dirty little job. So shoot me in the leg.
Always get your man?
Of course.
Think you'll get me?
I hope so.
Early. Please come with the money, or you keep the car. All my love, Tommy.
Thank you.
And that was Thomas Crown Affair in 1968, which was remade, I forget when that was, in the 2000s, recently by Pierce Brosnan.
And Rene Russo.
Rene Russo, one of your mom's favorite movies. And this was also Steve McQueen's, looking back on his career, he said this was probably his favorite movie.
Really?
And probably one of the reasons he got to play against character because he had a high school education. He went into the military. Well, he actually came out of boys' school because he had a rough childhood. And he got to play a businessman who's Ivy League educated and is also a pretty cunning thief in the movie.
Right.
So he was, he really fought for this role. They didn't really want him in this movie. He had to go against the producers and the director to get the part. Norman Jewison, is it pronounced?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you interned for him, you should know how it's pronounced. And so this movie was scored kind of funny because the composer watched a rough cut of the movie. He went on vacation, he wrote the score, and came back with the score, and they cut the movie to fit his music instead of the other way around. Usually the composer has to make the movie or the music fit the movie.
Oh yeah, definitely.
In this case, they did it the other way around. They cut the movie to fit his music.
That's a little unusual.
Yeah, and the original choice for the title role in this movie was Sean Connery, but he turned down the part.
Ooh, that would have worked. I suppose they both have the same type of sex appeal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the last piece of trivia about this movie is that the two leads, Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway.
Yeah, came to wow. Me. I was like, did you forget that?
Yeah, they have a kissing scene, which lasts 1 minute in the movie, but it took 8 hours to film over a number of days.
No.
So you can imagine how that worked out. Talk about it.
I do know that on the CD cover for this score that there was actually them in mid-kiss, so.
Yeah. Well, they had
because they made the most of that.
Yeah, they had plenty of practice on that one.
I guess. I suppose they hated each other afterwards, huh? Okay, so we're in the middle of listening to The Reavers from 1969. Now, we don't have anything to say about this one because you didn't even like that movie.
Well, it was a role of Steve McQueen's. Whenever he tried to play something funny, that really wasn't his forte. Whenever he had a part in a movie that called for him to be kind of a comedian, a funny buffoon, and he just didn't really pull that off for me.
Yeah, that's not. It doesn't seem like.
And in this movie, he kind of has that kind of a part. The Reavers is basically a slang for someone who lies and steals and cheats. And that's basically was Steve McQueen's part in the
movie.
But
laughing the whole way.
Yeah, but he was kind of like a lovable bad guy or thief. And the whole movie was based on a novel by William Faulkner. So it's about an old man looking back on his life 60 years into the past and... his coming-of-age movie, basically what it is. And to me, Steve McQueen was probably the weakest link in the entire movie.
Wow. The one and only time.
Yeah, so, yeah, it wasn't really a part that was cut out for him, but he wanted to do it. So, of course, by then he was a star and
right,
he had a lot of power.
Right, he could do whatever he wanted by
right,
then.
So.
And the score sounds really good. It's by John Williams.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, we're in the middle of playing The Rejected Suite of The Getaway by Jerry Fielding. We have a little bit of trivia on that.
Well, the trivia is that Steve McQueen by now in his career had quite a bit of power over what happens with directors and even in this case with composers. He wasn't too thrilled with the Jerry Fielding version.
I'd have to say this kind of after listening to a little bit of it here that it kind of sounds like a horror film, like it's from The Omen or something.
Well, yeah, I'm not really too sure exactly what it was that he didn't like about the score, but he rejected it. Steve McQueen did. And he got Quincy Jones to do a score for the film, which was kind of a lighter, jazzier touch to it, and he was happier with that. And so this one got relegated to the... to what were you calling it before? Something about a deleted or a...
It's rejected score.
A rejected score, which...
Yeah, which is on CD. I've seen it on a couple different CDs. Like, this is from a set of Jerry Fielding's film music. It's a 4-CD set.
Yeah, it kind of reminds you of the story about 2001 when the original score by Alex North for that movie was rejected for the more classical music that eventually was used for the movie.
So, right.
In The Getaway, which was in 1972. In fact, this reminds me of a person who visited my website who was actually on the set during part of the time that they were shooting The Getaway.
Really?
And he talked about how they were always fooling around on the set and how you could see the sparks were starting to ignite between the stars, Ally McGraw and Steve McQueen.
Oh, yeah, and they eventually got married.
Right, they were married to different people at the time.
Oh.
But they evidently liked each other enough to leave their respective spouses and marry.
Why does that always seem to happen more in Hollywood?
I don't know.
To be more accepted, too,
yeah.
To fall in love with your co-star.
Well, something about
creative
minds, I guess.
Even if you're still if you're both married to other people, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It'll work out.
Yeah, the movie was directed by Peter... Well, it wasn't directed by... What am I saying? It was directed by Sam Peckinpah, as most people know or are familiar with The Getaway. This was also another movie that was remade, but it was... remade, I believe, in the 1990s by Alec Baldwin and the blonde movie star that he married for a while.
Kim Basinger?
Kim Basinger, right.
You know what? I think I do remember that.
Yeah. And that wasn't too bad, but it wasn't as good as the original, of course.
Yeah, I think that was like mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'd have to look that up, but...
Yeah, but here again is Steve McQueen and Sam Peckinpah. They didn't get along with each other either. And in this particular case, the person who was on the set told me that Steve McQueen came up behind the director and shot a gun off behind his head.
Oh, my God.
And the director got so mad that they got into a tussle and rolled down the hill fighting with one another.
Oh, that's not funny.
No, but it's a classic Steve McQueen move.
Oh, wow.
And that's why he had the reputation of being the bad boy in Hollywood.
Okay, well, let's move on then from The Getaway and get into Papillon. Is that how you say that? Papillon? French?
Papillon, and Americans say Papillon.
Right, or I do anyway. And that's 1973, and that's Jerry Goldsmith. And then we'll end the show today with John Williams and The Towering Inferno, which was a TV movie.
Mm.
Made for TV, epic miniseries.
No, it wasn't made for TV.
It was a film?
Yeah, it was an actual film.
How come I remember? Oh, I know. The first time I ever saw it was on TV.
There you go.
Oh, boy. Well, see, that's why you're the expert, and I'm glad that you're on the show today. Thank you.
Yeah, and when it played on TV, I believe, because it's such a long movie, they cut it up into sections. So
yeah, it was like a miniseries.
You're right. It seemed to...
And I was really young.
It might have shown over three nights or something like that at the time, right?
Wow, what is this? This crazy cowboy music we're hearing there. Okay, let's move on. Moving on.
Are you interested in getting more involved in the Madison community but don't know where to start? The Morgridge Center for Public Service can help. The Morgridge Center promotes citizenship and learning through service within local, national, and global communities and builds on the Wisconsin Idea, a strong tradition of service to the community by students, faculty, and alumni. The Morgridge Center is a great resource for volunteer opportunities, internships, alternative break, and service learning courses, and is always looking for new ways to get UW-Madison students more involved in the community. For more information, stop in the center, located on the first floor of the Red Gym at 716 Langdon Street, room 154, Monday through Friday between 8:30 a.m. and 5 p.m., or visit www.morgridge.wisc.edu.
Thank you.
And we're in the middle of listening to The Towering Inferno.
Yeah, what's interesting about this particular track is that it introduces the movie. It's the first 5 minutes of the movie that's called a helicopter sequence. And the director, Irwin Allen, didn't really want music for it. But John Williams, who scored the movie, says, you know, I've done something for this part. Why don't you take a listen to it? And he says, you did. And he says, so he listened to it and he said, yeah, I like it. Let's put it in the movie. And there is it.
That's what you just heard.
That's right.
And now we're getting into Something for Susan. Now, who is Susan in the movie?
There were so many stars in this movie.
I know.
I can't even remember them
all. I do remember once, didn't we talk about something where it was Paul Newman and Steve McQueen needed, like Steve McQueen wanted his billing to be before Paul Newman's and they couldn't agree. And so on the poster, like they have equal measures of importance.
Right. They had to have, if Steve McQueen was going to come second on the poster, his name had to be higher on the poster, even though he was mentioned second. So that was his way of kind of equalizing the credits on the movie poster.
Even though I thought they were equal.
Oh, they were. They were paid the exact same amount of money to be in the movie, $1 million plus 7.5% of the gross.
Wow.
Which was quite a bit of money, but then these guys had star power at the time. Steve McQueen always had a rivalry going on with Paul Newman ever since the movie Somebody Up There Likes Me, where Paul Newman played Rocky Graziano, was a boxing movie, and Steve McQueen had a very minor part in it. And that jealousy from that early beginning where Paul Newman was the star of a movie and Steve McQueen was a bit actor, and now here they were in 1974 and they were basically on equal footing with one another. And Steve
well,
McQueen,
that should have been enough for him, but
well,
no.
It wasn't.
It's Steve McQueen we're talking about.
Yes,
here.
And his insecurities, which are infamous in the stories about things that he did during his life. And in this movie, you can better believe that he was going to get his share of the credit in this film. And he they actually wanted him to play the architect in the film, which was the part that Paul Newman played.
Right.
But he didn't want that part. He wanted the action part of the fire chief who takes
which
control.
I think fits.
Yeah, takes
that fits his personality
situation.
More.
Puts out the fire and saves the day. So that was for Steve McQueen. So yeah, it was this actually the entire subject of this movie, the towering inferno, the burning skyscraper, was inspired by the World Trade Center, which had just been built, and inspired two books, fictional books. One was called The Glass Inferno, and the other one was called, I believe, The Tower. And so when they made the movie, they blended the two books into one, since they were about the same thing, basically, and they merged the titles, and hence she came up with The Towering Inferno for a title. And it was a big hit at the time. They had, as was the habit at the time in the 70s, they would just take this big, expensive movie and then just jam it full of stars, both new and old, and they would just, you know, people would go see it in droves and it would make a lot of money. So
all right, and we'll be seeing that in New York on Monday.
Yeah, and so as I said, 1974, Steve McQueen would pass away 6 years later in 1980, and he only made a few more movies after this. So this was his last of his really big ones. Yeah, big blockbuster.
All right, thanks for listening to the Movie, Music, and Trivia Show on 91.7 WSUM Madison. Thanks for joining me, Dr. G, Mr.
Always
G.
Always fun, always.
Be sure to listen every Sunday morning for the show. I'm not sure when I'll be on for the summer, but typically it's 8 to 10, and I guess that's it. Hope you enjoyed the music, and thanks for listening to WSUM.